We've grown up in a society where discussing our own sexuality with our family, friends, and peers has been taboo and riddled with misconceptions. Many of us feel shame, guilt, and embarrassment around sexuality and intimacy. We are often unaware of how to engage with our own sexuality in a way that is safe for ourselves and for others. Comprehensive sexuality education goes beyond the mechanics of human biology. It equips us with the tools to navigate our relationships with informed consent and respect for personal boundaries, and helps us develop a better understanding of our own minds and bodies. It can radically reduce incidences of sexually transmitted infections and unintended pregnancies, address the endemic issues of gender-based violence, and enhance our self-expression and sexual well-being. Welcome to Safe Spaces, a four-part series by the Bangalore International Centre, in which Dr. Sangeeta Saxena takes us on a deep dive into the realm of sex and sexuality. Dr. Sangeeta is a gynecologist, author, counsellor, and activist. She co-founded Enfold India in 2001 to promote gender equity, sexuality, and personal safety education. In this episode, we take a look at the factors that shape our beliefs and behaviors in the bedroom. I am Anisha Tawag, and you're listening to Safe Spaces. We see even today there's a lot of variation in how people choose to marry and have children. So it's quite obvious that monogamy has not always been the norm. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So when scientists want to study and want to figure out what is our natural way to be human beings in the jungle, maybe one thing is, of course, they can study tribes, but the tribes have also come under influence of various factors. They also study other non-human animals, and they study things like the white blood cell count in your blood, because a group that is very sexually very active and has multiple partners, multiple chances of getting STIs, sexually transmitted infections, so you would have a higher white blood cell count. And those species, there are species of birds and other animals that mate only once in their life. And if the mate passes away, then they don't mate with anybody else. So the white blood cell count over there. Then they also look at things like the size of the penis, the size of the testes, the proportion of these two to the total size, the size of the male and the female, the differences there, because everything gets then linked also with parenting and so many other factors. So what they found is human beings, if you have a spectrum of extremely, what we say, promiscuous, I don't like that word, but extremely sexually active, multiple partners, like the bonobo monkeys and other animals like that, and you take these strictly monogamous animals, then our white blood cell count falls more towards monogamy, but it is not monogamous. So our natural state would be to have certain number of partners, but that number of partners may not be in hundreds, right? It may be a lesser number. So you find that many people are pretty happy in a monogamous marriage also, or a relationship also, but that is not our true actual nature. We are not monogamous by design. And we see that all the time, right?
Yeah.
People do divorce or break up, move on. And we have always had this males having multiple female partners.
Yeah.
And we don't even think twice about
polygyny, right? Where there's a man and he has many women partners.
Yeah. So it's also the same is true for the female also. But at the same time, I must also say that the male and the female are not equal in the way they reproduce, the investment they make in reproduction, and therefore how many partners they may choose to have or not have. So, you know, it's a very simple thing. If there were 10 men and 10 women in a group living together, you would have 10 children, for which one man is enough. But if you had only one woman, you will have only one baby. Right? So this kind of biological maths, all animals know. Nobody has to teach them this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the desire ingrained by nature in the individual is to have as many babies as you can before you pass on. So that's why you have this thing of the males trying to attract the female. That is how it is in nature. You will find it's the male bird who sings. It's the male frog who croaks.
Often the male bird that has the more attractive plumage.
Yes, the peacock, right? So they know that this female can go to any of the males and have that baby. Then I have lost that egg, I've lost. So let her choose me instead of the other one. So for reproduction, they would compete within the group with each other. For survival, they may fight against the intruder, right? For example, soldiers, when they're at war with the enemy, they will do anything to save their fellow soldier, right? Go into the hail of bullets, pull him back and, you know, carry him and all of that and save his life. And when the war is over and they go back to their hometown, they'll be competing with the same girl.
It sounds like this is just a social phenomenon we have where there's always a shifting dynamic within a group, but then a group is sort of, it defines itself in relation to another group.
Yes, yes. You see, life is not born with any privileges. Life just happens. And it has to find its food, find its mate and go on in the environment which is constantly changing. For us, being in a group has always helped. We survive in a group, we fight in a group, we reproduce in a group. So it's important to do that.
I want to come back to talking about the selection of partners and just look at how this process of maybe ownership of land and marriage, maybe even polygyny, it started to become codified. There was marriage at some point. I'm sure you have something to say about when that began or how it took shape.
It was a slow process. As I said earlier, the householder could have as many women as his land could afford to have, and they would all live with him. And eventually they were converted into wives in the sense that no more going out and all, and you will have sex with me and all that. But because all the food had to come from his land, there was a limit. So if you were the chief and you had huge lands, you could have many women with you. And if you were poorer and lesser land, you would have maybe one or two. And if you were the landless laborer, then God save you and your women, right? Because they are the ones who are even trafficked today. So why I'm bringing in this, yeah, this exploitation, this trafficking and sex work as being called the oldest profession, right? This is because it's linked with our non-monogamous nature. We feel attracted towards multiple individuals through our life, and we do want to have sex with multiple different people. Now, you take this man, in his house, he has controlled the women with whom he's going to have children who are going to inherit his land. And as time progressed, they codified it. It became written down. Have you read Manu Smriti?
I have not.
Please do read it. Your blood will boil, probably for 10 years or more. So it was all written down, right, by a man. Now, there is this desire to have sex with multiple women. Where do I find them? Right? I have one wife, maybe two, but that's not enough. Right? So you have this oldest profession. Who were these women? They were probably the girls, the daughters, the wives also of this landless laborer. These are the children who get trafficked even today. It's not our children. Our children don't get trafficked. It's the children from remote villages. They don't have resources. Their parents have abject poverty, whatever. Not enough information, technology. To even go behind and trace their child who has been brought to a big city like Bombay or Bangalore. So this whole thing started, and that's what I call the making of two types of women. The marriageable types who were growing up in my neighbor's houses. Every household that had enough land had girls, and the father would ensure that they remained a virgin and they remained marriageable so they could be given off to somebody with good resources, right? Because now it's not like a tribe in the jungle. So the father is looking at who has a lot of land. Where will my daughter and her children be safe and have enough to eat? Of course, they will work on the land, but is there land? How much is it? And the man is looking at, okay, your daughter is fine. His daughter is also fine. She's more beautiful to look at. I'll take her.
And she will probably bear me more beautiful children.
Maybe. Right?
Taller men.
Huh. So the dowry business started. Okay, marry my daughter. I will give you this much money, this much food or whatever, but never land. Land is never given in dowry. So that started out. Also, the male is now the chooser. See how from the bird who is dancing, singing, doing what acrobatics to get the female to attract. And that is our nature. It is in our nature for the male to sing and dance and, you know, prove themselves worthy of this girl. But we don't see that. We don't see that now. What we see is that the female is bedecked from head to toe. Pluck the eyebrows, shave, this, that, whatever you want, I will do. You want small feet? Right? My grandmother will break my bones when I'm 2 months or 2 years old. Tie them up, make me have small feet, and give a nice name, lotus feet. Right? That happened in China until the party banned it. In Nigeria, it was like long neck. How do I get a long neck? Every year, a ring is put in my neck, increasingly, slightly stretching. Eventually, it is so stretched that if you take out those rings, the muscles are not strong enough, that my head will fall on the side. I can't hold my head up. So even today, the punishment for suspected infidelity of the wife is to cut those rings. She can't sit up. She has to lie down. She can't swallow. She'll die. In the Western world, there was this exaggerated female figure. Tight corset.
Mm-hmm.
Very tight corset. So tight that the lower ribs were deformed.
Mm.
And that's why they used to faint in these balls and all.
They couldn't breathe.
Ah, there's less oxygen. There's so many people in that room. They would faint. If you take the symmetry, like any other feature, it would be distributed in a bell curve. And in that bell curve, there'll be median and then two standard deviations. So bulk of people would be ordinary looking, healthy. Some people at the extreme end would be very beautiful.
Mm.
And some people on this end would not be so attractive to look at. But majority would fall in that bell curve and they would be ordinary to look at, mm-hmm. okay to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And have children also, right? So it's not like the most beautiful will have the most children. It was just that if I'm choosing and there is no other criteria for me, her education, her nature, her culture, nothing matters, then I will go for the most beautiful because I feel that attraction towards her more than the other one. No? So that's why they were choosing the beautiful one.
It's interesting to look at this phenomenon of trying to groom a woman to match a certain standard of beauty, because the beauty was maybe connected with her fertility and what kind of children she could produce. And when we look back, maybe at that time, that was the norm. But I'm coming back to thinking about why some characteristics of men and women that had a relevance hundreds of years ago are still part of our practices today. So something that I often think about is weddings and the rituals during weddings. And in so many customs, there is a practice of handing over the daughter. A friend of mine said that she had asked the priest, this was a Brahmin wedding, and she had asked the priest why she needed to sit on her father's lap during the kanyadan. And the priest said it's because earlier this would have been a child marriage, and so the child would have to be held and then given to the other side. But this was a grown woman in her late 20s, and the ritual doesn't really hold any significance today, but we still practice them. And I want to ask you what that says about our conceptions of gender, of sexuality, and of coming together as pair bonding.
There are so many traditions which are rooted in all of this, this kind of gender bias and this kind of enforced restrictions. It is up to us to change them.
Mm-hmm.
So in my family, from the time of my mother, then my marriage, then my daughter's marriage, we never gave any dowry. There was no kanya dan.
Mm-hmm.
My mother told the priest very clearly and her parents, if you try to do kanya dan, I will get up from the mandap and run. And they knew that she would. Right? Same story with my daughter. And, you know, so all of these is up to us to change.
Yeah.
Right? So even the Mr., Mrs., Ms., what is this? Why do you want to know whether I'm married or not?
Mm-hmm.
But long back, it was very important to know whether she's married or not.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they had from head to toe, they had a sign of marriage.
Mm.
No? From the sindoor, red bindi,
yeah.
Whatever that nath, and then going downwards, and then the bichya, the, you know, the toe rings.
Yeah.
And any part of the woman you look at, you can say whether bangles,
yeah.
The color of the bangles, all of that. Nothing on a man. Because it was not... His sexuality was not under control.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to us to change all of that. There is no law which says that you have to.
Mm-hmm.
And marriages can be done without any of these sit on my lap and kanya dan and all. Mm-hmm. For a Hindu wedding, I think it's just that fire and going around and taking your vows. That's the main part. Arya Samaj wedding would be different.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to us. And change won't come from outside.
I'm thinking about the women's movements in the West, which I think we also looked to a lot and continue to look to. And I read in Bell Hooks, I think this was in her book called Communion, where she talks about how the feminist movements made room for women to find parity in the workplace and in public, but not at home. And this is quite a mainstream fact. Everyone knows it. We've had ads with hashtag share the load trending. But I want to go a step beyond just sharing household labor and talk about emotional labor. Because I think that when we've looked at these gendered expectations around marriage that come from our evolutionary history, maybe we fail to look at what our lives now require of us. So I just want to ask you to maybe reflect on how when we raise children and when we are raised, we're given certain ideals to strive for. So when you're a boy, you have to be a certain kind of boy. And when you're a girl, you have to behave a certain way. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
I know there would also be a lot of Indian writings
mm-hmm.
on feminism, women's movements in India by Indian women over the centuries. And there have been quite a few. So it's not that I'm against any Western thought. But I feel that our way of thinking and responding is so embedded in the cultural reality that you can't import ideas and implement them. They're bound to fall flat. Having said that, I'll give you an example of how parenting can look like. So my daughter recently had a baby. And once the baby was born, the father was in the labor room. It was a cesarean for some reason. And he cut the cord. And the baby had a little issue, but very soon the baby was given to him to hold. Of course, it was given to my daughter also. He immediately took off his shirt, put the baby skin to skin on his chest, and he was walking around and holding her. And till date, he is able to soothe her very well.
That's lovely.
And, you know, there are studies which show that while breastfeeding, there's a lot of oxytocin that is being produced in the mother. Of course, the baby has a skin contact, so baby also has. The mother has a good amount of oxytocin. And we thought, wow, you know, what a bonding this is creating. What they found is a father who is touchy-feely with the child has the same level of oxytocin.
Wow.
So his bonding with his child can be as strong as the bonding that a breastfeeding mom develops with the baby.
That's fascinating.
Uh-huh. So my pet peeve is that You know, we have gone and gendered our qualities, our human qualities. Yeah. But human qualities, we have them because they're required for our survival. Mm-hmm. Our intelligences also. We have them because they're required for our survival. If you imagine a child with no logical thought, you know, no musical, no spatial, whatever, multiple intelligences, that child is not capable of survival, right? Similarly, qualities help us live in a group. If you imagine a child with no care, no integrity, no authenticity, no kindness, no friendliness, they might commit such horrendous crimes that they won't be able to survive in that group. So our qualities help us survive in the group. Our intelligences help us survive. And to gender them is such a foolish thing to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Such a foolish thing to do. I was talking to this guy, he's from Iran, a young student in a college. And he said, you know, Sangeeta, in my country, a man has to be aggressive, has to be dominant, has to be brave, has to be this. Otherwise, he's not masculine. He's not man enough. And I was like, I said, okay, but he's a human first. And he's born with all these qualities. How clever is it to say that I know more than nature and tell the boy, don't develop those other qualities, only these. So aren't you creating a distorted man and a distorted woman? And then you are expecting them to live a well-balanced, harmonious life? Not possible.
I'm glad you brought this up in this way, because I do want to dig into the spectrum on which masculinity exists. I think in the recent past, there are more, maybe also with a large support from the queer community, people exploring masculinities rather than a singular form of masculinity. And I think that this troubles our ideas of what men should be and what they should look like. But there's also a great interest now in men being able to inhabit various qualities that maybe they weren't allowed access to in the past. There's a sense in some men's rights groups, Meninists, that feminism and what in our country we often refer to as women empowerment as a threat to the social order or to their own masculinity. But I think the threat is something that they're perceiving because there are also men who are rejecting more traditional ideas of masculinity.
So in Enfold's work, in our curriculum, you won't find these words at all. Feminism, masculinity, femininity. But what you will find a lot of is human, human, human. Let us respect each other as human beings. I hate that respect girls. What is this? Huh? What's that? Or respect a certain part of your body. Respect each and every part of your body, each and every function of your body, each and every part of other bodies and their functions. So I have a problem with this. You know, what is masculinity? What is femininity? No, I'm saying, please don't get into that minefield at all. Mm. Be a human being. Your gender is not, it's a part of your identity. It's not your whole self.
Yeah.
Like intelligence is not gendered.
Yeah.
Qualities shouldn't be gendered. They are not. So don't go around doing this and then trying to fit people. Am I into this? No, be a human. Explore all your qualities. Let's just like when a baby is born and you say, oh, you're a male baby. Average height of a male should be, 5 feet, 8, 9, 10 inches. So please grow to a height of 5 feet, 10 inches, not an inch less, not an inch more. We don't do that. Because we understand it is nature with so many other factors. Same thing for our qualities. Why?
I think what I'm getting is that all of these qualities exist on the plane of human existence, on in human experience. And what we need to do more of is allow people to explore who they are rather than what their gender dictates that they should be. But we're not immune to toxic ideas of gender, right? We are quite
often unconsciously recreating these tropes, the toxic male and as a result, the toxic female. How do you think that we can raise awareness, not just among children, but even among adults, to sort of allow maybe more emotional access in males? And maybe that changes how girls and women occupy the relational space between themselves and men.
Absolutely, absolutely true. So that's the way it would be. To the male child, you would ask the child to use words. Express your feelings. What are you feeling? What are you feeling? We have this word for it. It's okay to cry. It's for a reason. Nature has made tear glands, right? Otherwise, we would have done away with them. Also, to respect our nature and our natural tendency that may arise. This tendency to be hierarchical is seen not only in human male babies. What they have seen is that human males, once they join preschool, even preschoolers, grade one, within a few days of starting that class, the boys, through rough and tumble games, have established an hierarchy.
A pecking order, yeah.
Okay.
On the playground.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's inbuilt. Don't have to do anything about it. Don't have to worry about it, except when that hierarchy is being practiced. So if that strongest boy is now using his power to steal your homework and your stuff and done, and then even bullying, all of that can be taught to be his more physical strength, can be put towards protection rather than predation.
Subjugation, yeah, predation.
So I had this father, he's from Africa, and he was a parent sitting in an international school, and he stood up and he said, we teach our boys that to be masculine is to be protective. You have this extra power, use it positively to construct, to help, to support, rather than destroy, right? So power with people rather than power over people.
And I also think it's worth reflecting on how sometimes creating an ideal for masculinity as it was maybe a few decades ago, it's not going to work today, because maybe even younger generations of boys don't want to exhibit violent behaviors. Maybe they don't want to fall into some of the tropes that their parents did. But then there might be a pressure to become a new kind of real man. And that can put different pressure on young people.
Yeah, so any kind of... It's just like a plant is growing. Let it grow. Feed it water and nutrition and all of that. Yeah. And then let it blossom. Nature knows better than any one of us.
Mm-hmm. The less we interfere, the more we allow, the better. But at the same time, what we think of as what nature ordained is also varied because of our institutions, our religious and spiritual learnings, our communities.
Yeah.
So how do we access a kind of natural, for lack of a better word, state of being, and continue to check our biases?
So as societies grew, they could be controlled through physical power, of course, the king, and also through this fear of the unknown, what happens after death and all of that. So the priest, the natural events that would happen, lightning, this, that, floods, fear of God, right? So between the priest and the king, they validated each other and they ruled, the population was ruled. The king was the male, right? Very few queens. The priest could have been anybody. Could have been a male, could have been a female, could have been anyone. But this was also taken by the males by saying that, oh, during menstruation, you are sinful, dirty, gone. Can't pray to God. So finished. So they have taken over. But the point is that in today's world, you are making a choice to bully somebody, to taunt somebody, to tease somebody. And what we talk to children about, discuss, is that if somebody is commenting on your body, you're not tall enough, you're not big enough, you're too flat, whatever it may be, you say, listen, this is the way my body was made. I had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
You have a problem with my body? Please write to the manufacturer and send. God, what is this? What kind of bodies you're making? Kuch aata jata nahi hai. I don't know how to make bodies, but please don't. Right? That is one thing. And also understand that you are making a choice. Every time you open your mouth, every action you take is a choice. So become aware of that. Whether I'm bullying somebody, whether I'm using power over somebody, or I'm building friendships, which often last a lifetime. People remember, you might remember people in your class, in your college. That one, oh no, not to be trusted. That one, oh yeah, she was very fair. He was also very kind or whatever. So build your self-esteem, know yourself, and here the self is, which are the qualities well-developed in you? Which are the intelligences well-developed in you? The intelligences are not in competition with each other. In linguistic is as important as logical is as important as a sense of time and rhythm and spatial and all of that.
Yeah.
Don't put them in a hierarchy. Recognize which ones are well-developed in you and work more towards that. Others you will need somewhat to clear your 12th, to clear your whatever. But know that. Know also which qualities are well-developed in you. And those are your strengths. Work on them, develop them. We don't, all of us have to be intelligent in the same intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
No, because we live in a group, it works. Somebody is good at math, somebody at language, somebody at making that column, somebody at cooking, somebody at dance. Sabka kaam chal jata hai.
We form a community with everyone's strengths put together.
Yes.
Right? And I think even this spectral existence that we have, where even things that we perceive as feminine and masculine, the fact that they exist on a spectrum, even in the animal kingdom, if we need to keep making that reference, it kind of reflects that varied gendered and sexual expression is also part of human experience. But maybe you could tell me a little bit about why it's so difficult for us as a community, as a society, to accept aberrations from the norm. This one is not enough of a boy. You need to be more like a girl. Why is this so difficult for us?
It's just self-work that you need to do. Really, it's for each person. Like we say, each person has a spirit, a soul, which is on a journey, which wants to become more self-aware, self-expressed. So don't expect solutions in a bottle and take 3 spoons a day. No. It's self-work, introspection, thinking about it, reading or watching YouTube videos from authentic sources.
Hmm.
Just a person wearing a white coat doesn't make that person a doctor. Where is their name? From which institution are they? Right? Don't just consume things, because something you hear, you cannot unhear. Something you see, you cannot unsee. It will affect you. Just as you are very aware of what you put in your mouth and what you eat, be aware of what you're feeding your brain. It will affect your behavior.
So it's kind of both the process of building ourselves up from the inside in terms of self-esteem and values, but also from the outside, what are we taking from the outside world?
Yeah. And your self-esteem shouldn't be based on looking down on someone. No. I also wanted to share this thing about masculinity, fatherhood, or parenthood for that matter. We think, womanhood, motherhood, fatherhood, we hear. But there was this homosexual penguin couple in the zoo in New Zealand, I think. And they were 6 such couples. And the zoo was like, how will we ever get more penguins? So they got some females imported females arrived. And they thought the males would change their mind, but they didn't. Anyway, so some of them, they did have babies. And what they noticed is that this one homosexual couple, penguin couple, wanted to have a baby. So they would take these stones and put them on their feet and stand, thinking that a chick will come out. And of course, nothing happened. But then one heterosexual couple, for some reason, rejected their egg. And these two fathers went and they took that egg and all. And eventually a chick came out.
That's
and wow. They were so thrilled. Those two fathers running around the baby, cuddling it, you know, whatever they were doing. This desire to have babies, care for babies, is not the prerogative of any one sex or gender.
I've been working with Touch quite intensively since about 2016. And the work was a lot with performers. I continue to work almost on a weekly, monthly basis with actors and dancers in this space. I then take that to the community in the form of tools. In working with professional performers, I work a lot with the different ways in which in which touch exists in our world. So there is, for example, there is one kind of touch that tells you what to do, and your imagination will collude with it and place it in a context, and you will take an action. If you feel something cold on your back, a feeling of something steel and cold, and you're in a dark alley, you will know that you are in danger, and you might freeze, or you might run, or you might shout for help. If you're playing around at home with a little niece or a nephew and you feel something cold, you'll know that they've picked up a toy or something from the kitchen and they are, you know, teasing you or playing with you. That kind of touch travels really, really fast to the brain and tells you exactly what to do in a matter of the speed of thought. Then there's the kind of touch that slows you down and that tells you how to feel. And that travels like at a snail's pace to the brain. It's the kind of touch when you're soothing someone, stroking or caressing. So it's basically an entire language. The touch is saying things that, thank God, our words have not been able to catch up with and probably won't. Because there's a certain nuance that words, because of the binary of language, immediately kind of disrupt. So I'm interested in that, in preserving that. Even as we go through the social revolution of good touch, bad touch, of people being able to say what they are okay with, not okay with, so necessary. And yet, in systematizing something like touch, one does lose a little bit with the sort of the natural place that touch has in our lives and in the practice of intimacy. Through this work with performers over the years, I have offered these tools to the community. And what I often found was that the world outside was really present in our touch work and intimacy work within. So for example, when Me Too became the big movement of the day, that had found its way into the workshop space, and the men were kind of very, very tentative about, even when asked to reach out and touch a body next to them, there was so much shaking and hesitation. And I noticed some of the women in the group then take over and say, it's okay, you can touch. And if you do anything that we find to be problematic, we'll tell you. And this is where you practice it. And so the women were ensuring safety in a very specific way. Something that really stood out to me and felt like a real tragedy as well was the way that parents were mourning the loss of their innocent tactile relationships with their children who were, let's say, now suddenly adolescents. So a father who had a really playful, wrestling, cuddling, public, affectionate relationship with his daughter, now that she was suddenly 12 and looking very different, her body was changing, he would get really dirty looks in public if she came and sat on his lap or cuddled him or bit him or pinched him. And he was having to kind of wean her away from that touch relationship. There was a mother who talked about the same thing with her 15-year-old son. And also, in terms of the little girl, the tragedy of if she loses this safe masculine touch, and then probably her next touch experience will be, if you're an Indian woman, then somebody touches you inappropriately on the street, or if it's still a joyful, consensual situation with, say, a classmate, then that's a young boy who's learned a lot about touch from pornography. And so that safe masculine touch disappears and is replaced by a slightly
kind of perverse touch or a touch of someone who doesn't know and who has very different intentions. So there is some kind of tragedy in that, and I think the body remembers not just touch, but very much remembers the absence of touch.
I think I want to draw a distinction between here the sort of morality laid down by Victorian law and what our constitution encourages us to do, because they're sometimes not in sync. And we often refer to the constitution to help us dismantle some of the laws that are no longer relevant. And one of the laws that is obviously still very alarming is the exception to Section 375, which is the law on rape. The exception just says that sexual intercourse or sexual acts by a man with his own wife, the wife not being under 15 years of age, is not rape. And I'm bringing this up because somewhere all of our conversations about freedom of expression, building up self-worth, seem to be relevant only up to a point, because then we have a law that says, yes, you can have your freedom of expression unless you are someone's wife, in which case suddenly the freedom is curtailed just because you are someone's wife. It sounds like it sort of cements a lot of our ideas of what a man should be and what a woman should be, because at the end of the day, even if she's unwilling, she has to be willing. And that's a suggestion that comes from this phrasing. I think I'd like you to also just share how maybe we've historically sort of groomed women to aspire for these most feminine qualities of subservience. We've been talking a lot about boys, but how do we now address these qualities in girls?
So most of us live our lives not really cognizant of the law as such. Very few of us have read these laws and these acts. And I really feel a lot of things are interpersonal, relationship-based, which can be better addressed through conversations and understanding and maybe a more restorative approach to our day-to-day interactions with people, which is on power with rather than power over people. That's the gist of restorative practices and value-based. Each one has a right. Each one is equal. We are more powerful together rather than when we're trying to dominate each other. So trying to bring the law into the bedroom is not going to work, right? Even trying to bring the law into, say, the domestic violence. There is a law, but how many women would want to access it? Because that law is a criminal justice system. That's what we have been used to and what we have. But they don't want their husband to go to jail. They just want him to stop.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not that they don't want to have sex with their husband ever, because once they take it to the law, then you have to prove, right? How do you prove? Where is it? So it's very complex that way. It would be much more easier to focus on our relationships with each other. And I was talking about how to give consent. So one is how to ask for consent. And you have all the things, you know, you understand it can be withdrawn at any time, freely given, informed, not under the influence of alcohol or some such thing, or some duress or something like that. How do you also give consent? So here we dismantle all these beliefs that a lot of girls grow up with. One of my colleagues once told me long back that I used to think that in marriage, my husband will provide for me. And in return, I have to give sex.
Give sex. Like it's something
because
he can ask
this
for.
Sex is his need.
Right.
A woman shouldn't have sexual desires, you see? Then you are a bad woman. So that's what she said. Of course, it was several years ago, but still she said that. So we say, listen, you are not responsible for satisfying anybody. You know, sometimes a male may say, oh, you have brought me to this stage, I can't control myself. Of course you can. Of course you do. When they're growing up, erection can happen at any time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes sitting in the bus, sometimes in the classroom, sometimes wherever. So there are ways, right? You distract yourself, you use your bag, you use your book, somehow cover it, you're not sure, right? Masturbation, God's gift to mankind. Female kind,
yeah.
All kinds.
Yeah.
Because animals also masturbate.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Birds also. So there the thing is that you develop relationships which are based on respect. Everyone is capable of taking care of their needs. You have a right to satisfy your needs as long as you don't impinge on others' rights or their freedom and stuff like that. So if we have that kind of a relationship between the people, then they would rather talk about, I want to have sex, I don't feel like having it. How can your need be met and my need also? Yeah. There is something like mutual masturbation, there is just masturbation. There are so many myths about that also. Oh, if a married couple is masturbating or one of them is masturbating, means that the other one is not able to satisfy them. No, yeah. I'm just too tired. It's very easy.
I think right now in this conversation, we're able to appreciate how sexuality itself is not gendered. Sexual urges are not gendered. And you said earlier that we can't really compare who feels more of an urge and what that feels like. We can't really quantify these things.
But at the same time, I also want to point out that, yes, we have the hormones, which are the drivers of these things, physical changes as well as emotional and others, estrogen and testosterone. All sexes have both of them to varying degrees. And the big driver of sexual urges is testosterone. Females have it, males have more of it. Intersex people, variation would depend on what the variation is and according to that. So generally it is found that males will have 5 to 10 times more testosterone than the average female. And then depends on the age also, right? So given that, it is quite easy to understand that the sexual urge of a person may be more than that of a person from another sex.
And or just another individual.
Another individual. And there will be a huge variation within. In fact, there are more variations within the sex than between sexes. Almost anything. There is no competition, there is no comparison, there is nothing to prove here, right? You're whole and complete and full of joy and joy.
I think this sort of more holistic, wholesome perspective of sex is maybe what's missing in the way we articulate it, especially in the law, which I'm going back to again. Because I remember in 2012, after the Nirbhaya incident, and then there was the Justice Verma committee report, one of the recommendations that made was to remove the phrasing of outraging a woman's modesty. And I think that might have placed more focus on the woman's autonomy, because modesty again somehow suggests we have other words for this shame and large and all of that.
So this was a very successful tactic that was used by patriarchy to put the woman's entire respect in a part of her body. Your respect as a person depends on whether the hymen is intact or not and what has gone in. So, and whose was it? That is what is behind all of this. What we are trying to say is that respect comes from the way you behave. It is not in any part of your body. If I raise my hand and hit my mother, you will say, oh my God, what kind of a woman is she? If I help my mother, you say, nice woman, helping her mom. There's no shame in my hand. There's no respect in my hand. It is how I use it. So how I look at a person will bring me respect, or I may feel ashamed of it, or people may say this is inappropriate. Why are you looking like that at a person? So it's how I use my body. It is, respect is not a part of my body. I've been a gynecologist, operated on enough vaginas, never found a halo. Never.
Yeah.
There is nothing there. Right? Yeah. So let's get out of that and learn to respect every part.
Have the same desires to be free, to discover who we are, and to find meaningful connections with other people. And a lot of what you're saying comes back to education. So maybe to end, you could just share a little bit about how we can educate ourselves and each other more in this way.
Like I said, go to authentic, reliable sources. Pornography many people go to pornography as an educational tool, but it has a potential to really want you to come back again and again and again to it, can become habituated to it. Pornography may not always give you a good picture, right? An authentic picture. Mm-hmm. Also, the way it is produced may not be ethical at all times. It may be exploitative. Mm-hmm. It may give you a very gendered idea of how it happens. And it also strips sexuality out of, you know, only sex is shown. There are no emotions. You know, there's no story. There's nothing else. But that's not how our experiences are always embedded in a context. Right. Right? There is something there. It's again a myth that all boys like to watch pornography. Women don't like to watch pornography. No. All boys is also wrong. I had a friend, she was a participant, and she said, my son is in 8th, 9th grade or something, and sometimes he comes and says, Ma, I don't know what's wrong with my friends. They were passing around this, you know, on the USB, some blue film or pornographic film, and I don't like to watch them. And she was worried that there's something wrong with her son, that he is not interested in pornography.
Wow.
So her question was that, is there something wrong with him? I said, no. And just before that, I had read in a research article that males can use different strategies to leave their progeny behind, right? And they die. So one is to have multiple sexual partners. You can't be with them for very long. Some of them will get pregnant. Some of them will bring up the child. Some will may not. And the other strategy is to form a bond with one person and maybe have 10 children with that person over your lifespan. The first strategy also, maybe by the time they die, there may be 10 children they are leaving behind. Both strategies are successful. The females, on the other hand, they may feel attracted towards that macho guy who's, you know, so out there. But they want this steady type with them so that the babies are taken care and there's sharing of parenting and all of that. But how do you tell them apart? So the researchers were like, let's see, is there a difference in their height? No. Is there a difference in their penis size? No. Is there a difference in their testosterone levels? No. Is there a difference in their sperm count? No. Where is the difference? And you know where they found the difference? So they would call these men and put a wire around the penis, soft wire, and then a pornographic film is being shown. And then they actually see whether the person is getting aroused or not. Because if you ask them, they will say, nahi, kuch nahi. No. So they measured that. And that was the indicator. The male who is more interested in several females is more turned on by pornography and the way women are shown there and what is happening and being done to them. Whereas this other male strategy to form bonds and be loving and caring with female, those men were not really turned on by pornography. They were, in fact, what the hell is this? They didn't find it arousing.
Even if we look at the trends in the porn industry itself, there is a lot of what they call women's porn or feminist porn, queer porn now that has started to maybe deviate from the more mainstream porn. And I'd be curious to see if it's also a variation in what kind of pornography they're shown, what that says about the people that you described in this experiment.
Porn has always existed,
mm-hmm.
and it will always exist. That is because actual penetrative penovaginal part of the sexual activity is not instinctive. In the sense that if you take a male and female, they're sexually aroused, they have never been exposed to anything else. With that sexual arousal, they will come close, they'll be hugging, they may be lying on top of each other. The male will make thrusting movements, the female will arch her back towards him, but penetration may not happen because the vagina is not open like a pipe, right? And there is some pressure that has to be applied and you need to know that this is where it goes in.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. So every now and then, more so earlier, before we had the internet, we would get a patient, a couple, been married over a year, more than that, with a thick file of investigations done, no problem. Why are we not able to have a baby? So Dr. Shoiba had this patient and she asked, Are you having sex? Yeah. A penis is going inside the vagina. What?
Oh.
So then she had to explain. And I said, no. So what they were having is, we have a word for it, coitus bifemoris, which just means sex between the thighs.
Ah.
And then they looked at animals, monkeys. How do they learn about sex? So for that, they said, okay, let's take this growing up monkey, chota sa tha, usko. They brought it up in a way that it never saw an act of monkey sex. And then once it was an adult, they brought it back in the tribe. It would sit in the corner and masturbate. It would never have sex, though others were having sex. And they said, okay, now let's see what happens naturally. Naturally, what happens is when monkeys are having sex, all the bacha, kacha, chotas, adolescents will all come around and they will be observing, seeing what goes where. Sometimes so close to the couple that they find it difficult to do the sex part. Right? So that's why you'd find that on our temples of learning, our temples were temples of learning, centers of learning, you will find all forms of sexual activity depicted as sculptures or as drawings. That was the only medium available. But it is never at the bottom of the temple. It's high up on the wall, which a child of a certain height can then see and understand.
I guess we come back to education.
Yeah.
Even healthy sexual behaviors, we have to learn them.
Yeah.
Maybe there was a time when we could just slip into it, but
yeah.
That's not the case anymore.
This series was made possible with the generosity and knowledge of Dr. Sangeeta Saxena and the contributions of Abha Khetarpal, Dipankar Pant, Diya Naidu, Meghna Roy, Mitch Gupta, Nitya Devaya, and Saurabh Levin. We thank Vikram Bhatt and the team at the Bangalore International Center for their support. Safe Spaces was produced by Gaurav Krishna and Ishan Gupta. I am Anisha Tawag. Thank you for listening.